Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, my guest is my dear friend, Mary Trump. You may think that Mary needs no introduction because you believe that you know who she is in relation to a certain distasteful someone who shares her surname, or you have read her first best-selling book, Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, or her equally stellar second, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. But what an author produces or shares with the public is only part of who they are. And it should go without saying that our family of origin is a piece, but not all of us. My friendship with Mary developed not out of her written work or mine, but from a shared love of reading. Our first phone call back in 2021, we got lost in a discussion of our favorite books and films. Until then, I had not known she had not just a doctorate in psychology, but a master's degree in literature from Columbia University. Since that first conversation, we have had countless more about books. But one thing I have yet to ask her is how she came to love reading as a child, what her master's thesis focused on, and as a nonfiction author thus far, what her aspirations are for fiction writing. Let's dive in. So, sorry I'm late, Mary.
Sure. I'm actually just shocked you're here.
Oh, that's really unfair. You know what I was listening to on the car ride home from school?
I do not.
Amy Mann.
Oh.
I decided that if I was going to be late, I at least should be listening to your favorite music.
Yeah, I just have to hope that that's not an opportunity loss. But every once in a while, Mental Illness is, I think, my favorite.
That's what I was listening to, and Goose Snow Cone.
But... And that's probably one of my favorite songs of hers. But I think her first solo album is also Whatever, I think it's called, is phenomenal. That has 4th of July on it. But her latest album, and I'd actually love to talk to her about this, that I'm assuming it was written during COVID because it just came out last year. It's fucking phenomenal.
I'm not sure Highly if I've recommend. Listened to anything. Maybe when we're done talking. I will.
Yeah, you should absolutely. I can't off the top of my head remember what it's called. The title of it doesn't roll trippingly off the tongue, but it's... She just never ceases to amaze. Yeah.
And she is a lovely person if we're going to sit here and name drop.
She's, you know, it's one of those situations where you've known about this person, you've admired this person's work for seemingly forever, and then... You hope they're who you think they might be, and then they are. I had a similar experience. I mean, I never met Jane Fonda in person, but she interviewed me a long time ago, and it was the same thing. It's like, oh my God, you are a kind, decent, creative, funny, deep, empathetic human being who's everything I would want you to be. That does not happen often.
I would imagine. I have such a dark side, Mary, that I should be having my heart warmed hearing you say these nice things about how lovely Jane Fonda really is. But I'm tempted to ask you, have you ever thought a lot about a person and then met them in real life and they're kind of a complete disappointment?
Mm-hmm.
I've only had that happen once. I don't want to say who it was. Unless you drag it out of me.
Yeah, I don't want to. I mean, if we're recording, I won't say it.
I'm not afraid to say what I think. I never usually.
Yeah, I'm not. I think I told you. Somebody I met recently is just a total immature asshole. And you wouldn't think so, considering this person isn't very accomplished.
Well, I don't usually badmouth anyone. But this person, the only person I've ever met, I'm hoping that you'll drag it out of me, Mary, because I wouldn't just volunteer it.
Well, I'm not going to do the show if you don't tell me.
Okay, fine. Jeff Toobin.
It's still penciled in.
Jeff Toobin was a complete dick to me.
Don't use that word.
Oh, man.
And
that wasn't...
Toobin in the same
sentence. I don't mean that. I mean, I always looked up to him, and I met him on the set at CNN once, and we were going to be on air together. And I was, you know, talking about his work, like his book on the 2000 election and the hanging chads and the very complicated cases. And I had just reread it. And I think I was complimenting about him about something else. And he was like, not even, he was kind of just being a little bit rude. And then when we were on set, when he was talking, you know, he looked right at the camera and the host, and I looked at him like you're supposed to. But when I was talking, he was like looking it away like he was planning his next meal or something. And
yeah, he definitely deserved to be reinstated.
Wait, but there's more to this, Mary. Do you know what the topic was that I was on air for? It was like, well, you know how sometimes you're on and it's a last minute news story? Mm-hmm. It was about Bob Kraft getting in trouble at the massage parlor. So maybe he was just feeling uncomfortable about the whole topic.
You know, all these guys and their fucking reaction formation, it shouldn't surprise us. But you know what I did at the end of the show?
What show?
Well, you don't, because you weren't there at my show on Tuesday.
I wasn't there.
Is I was thanking everybody. I was wrapping up, you know, Dina Badala, Danny Moody. And I referred to Jen as Jen Toobin.
You did?
Like, why did I do that?
That is so weird.
And
it turned,
and I feel, I know. And I'm like, and then I was going to thank Norm. I'm like, I'm afraid to thank Norm because what am I going to call him? And I realized it's because I watched this quite silly show called My Life is Murder with Lucy Lawless. And that's why I watch it, because I love her. And there's a character, Ruben, one of her friends who runs a cafe, of all things. And she... She tells her other friend, oh, Ruben is going to feed the cat. And then Ruben doesn't know this. And she says, no, not Ruben. I meant Mrs. Toobin is going to. So the Ruben Toobin. So I wanted to explain that to Jen so she didn't think I was referring to Jeffrey Toobin. But it just seemed kind of too much to get into, as it is now. So maybe we should start
talking
about
something
much more interesting.
I had no idea. I didn't watch the show. No one told me. So this is this weird wavelength that connects us.
It must be unusual. That must be
that and our addiction to cult documentaries, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I need a new one.
Yeah. That's a little
personal.
More direct.
Okay. So I want to start by asking you where Sebastian.
Are we starting?
What?
Oh, Sebastian is at his babysitter's.
Wow. I don't see any cats.
I'm picking them up next
week.
Where's
Cap?
The cats ignore me like all day. I don't know. They're probably sleeping somewhere.
Okay.
I even got Cap a bird feeder so she would, you know, be more.
Where's
engaged.
The gecko?
She is sometimes, but right here, Nemo is plugging away.
Okay. Glad to hear that odd wound
on
her head has healed.
Healed, and it now matches her tail, which is a little freaky. It's like she got a skin graft without my knowing.
So have we done the full pet inventory? Is how's Cap's health?
Everybody's healthy. Cap's a little chubby. That's okay.
Okay.
She's active.
I miss Sebastian and hope to see him soon, and I'm almost ready to forgive him mm-hmm. for biting me.
Well, it'll happen again, so it's best to forgive him for this one.
So... Do you want to talk about books or no? I mean, I do that on this podcast, Mary.
I was thinking we would talk about like origami.
Do you
something.
Do origami?
No, let's talk about books. I'm a little more versed, shall we say,
so,
in books.
You know, I feel like I want to ask you about all kinds of things about books, but I think the easiest way to do this is to start at the very beginning. Like... Was there a moment when you fell in love with reading, or there was someone who made a difference in your life about being interested in books as a young person?
Yeah, I started reading when I was 3 and a half. We had neither of my parents was particularly intellectual, shall we say. But our next door neighbor, Peggy, I think she might have been a librarian, actually. Anyway, she taught me how to read.
How did that come about? Was she a babysitter or what?
No, I have no idea. But it you know, as was often the case, sort of parental obligations got delegated to other people. So, you know, which is who knows? I mean, maybe I was interested, and I mean, it's a little young to start reading. Like, I literally read my first book when I was 3.
Wait! But were you in a house or an apartment at that time?
Apartment,
so she was like
apartment
person next door, or across the hall.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So she was a neighbor.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what books she was teaching you with?
Yeah, we started with Dr. Seuss.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. And I believe the first book was Green Eggs and Ham.
Interesting. Do you still remember any of that?
followed closely by Cat in the Hat. And yeah, of course, I remember it very well. And I learned very quickly. And reading became possibly the most important thing in my life, followed very closely by sports.
Did Peggy teach you sports?
Not
too?
Watching, doing
Who
sports.
Who was your sports
No, I was
companion.
Just sort of a natural athlete. And, you know, going to a sailing camp sort of broadened my horizons as well. So I was a very active kid, but I also spent an inordinate amount of time in my room reading books.
And your mom, were you like in, was Peggy in your apartment? Do you remember being over next door visiting her when you were reading?
I don't. I mean, I think it was a combination of both, but I don't remember. I was little. It was a very, very long time
And after
ago.
That, like, were you the kind of person who someone, an adult, would take you to the library and you would get books, or did you go to bookstores or what?
You know, when we were young, because you're a little younger than I am, but we're essentially the same age, book clubs were a big thing.
Oh, right. Like Scholastic Book Club?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did you get to order whatever you wanted on that?
I did.
I hate that you. Sorry, I don't hate you, but like
really
I'm jealous.
Nice way to start the show. I mean, it was extraordinarily fortunate in that regard. Perhaps only in that regard. But yes, in that regard. And I mean, we also did go to the library a lot, but there was something for me about having it be mine, which has continued because, you know, probably like you, I'm one of those people who has thousands of books, many of which I have not yet read.
But that's kind of the point. I mean, you're supposed to have, it's like your home library. You may not dip into something, but then you eventually do when you need it.
Yeah. And I don't remember who said this, but it's, you know, it sort of ensures your immortality. If you have all these books in your possession yet to read, you have to stick around to read them.
Is that true? I haven't seen that bear out, Mary.
It's probably somebody said it. I didn't say it was true,
well,
but it does sort of make
repeated
you
repeated it.
There's always something to look forward to.
But so your Scholastic Book Club, because I'm having flashbacks to some of the books I got. Are there any in particular that you still have? I mean, do you have any of your children's books?
I don't. They might be, you know, in a basement.
Oh my God,
somewhere.
Mary. Wait a second. Can you wait 3 seconds? I swear to God. Hold on. Guess what? I was home visiting my parents this summer. And, you know, they always say, take whatever you want. And so
there's still stuff.
So I found some children's books of mine. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to show you, see if they bring back memories. A Bargain for Francis.
Yep.
And I loved this one. I think this is. Yeah. Okay. That. Did you have this Aesop's Fables?
It looks familiar, yeah.
Okay. How about a birthday for Francis?
Yeah, I wasn't really into Francis.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I read them, of course. I know.
I've got one more thing to show you, and I won't show you everything, but this book called Looking for Susie. Do you see this? I literally stole this from the library and hid it, apparently, under my bed. It still has the stamp from the library. And my parents had to pay the library. And they tried to lecture me that in the future I was going to have to return books on time. Otherwise, I would have exorbitant fines to pay. And I just made friends with the librarian in college and never had to pay my fines.
Wise.
See?
Very wise. Very wily.
But you like to own. I, too, obviously like to possess these books. What do you have?
Yeah. And I was very fortunate to be able to buy pretty much whatever books I wanted.
Do you have some, like, right now that you've gone back to? Not from early childhood, but, like, I'm thinking, are there some that speak to you still?
Yeah. I particularly liked Roald Dahl and William Steig. I think those, not all of their stuff, but, you know, some of their books really stand out. And there were other series, like Frog and Toad, and series that a lot of us read. But my two favorite
Did you just
books,
say Frog and Toad?
Yes.
Did you just say Roald Dahl?
That was my favorite. That was
James
tied.
And the Giant Peach. You was your
James and the Giant Peach. So, okay, obviously your reading gets more advanced as you grow. And I think by the time I was 7, I was done with sort of children's books and started reading sci-fi.
Oh.
But as a young reader, very young reader, my favorite book was William Steig's Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. And my second favorite book when I was a little bit older was Roald Dahl, James and the Giant Peach. Can't wait to see what the expurgated version.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what are your thoughts about that? Or maybe we shouldn't even comment.
Well,
what do you think about people?
They corrected themselves.
What?
So they corrected they're also publishing the unexpurgated versions. I just think it was a silly. I understand it in some ways, but you know, I think that's a conversation for another time.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
What's interesting about my two favorite books is that I never read them to my daughter.
Oh, why not?
Well, are you familiar with Sylvester and the Magic Pebble?
I am not. That one I don't think I know, but maybe you can refresh my memory.
Yeah. And again, when I say I love this book, that's an understatement. It was sort of like my lodestone or something.
No pun intended.
It's a very, right. It's very dark. It's a very, very dark, dark book. And I didn't know that at the time. But it's about a family of donkeys. Uh-huh. And Sylvester is the only child, and the mom and dad take Sylvester for a picnic, and he collects pebbles, as you can imagine. And he goes off to look for new pebbles for his collection, and he finds one that is perfectly round and red. Mm-hmm. And it starts to rain, and he has the pebble in his hoof, on his hoof, and he says, I wish it would stop raining. Next thing you know, the rain stops, the clouds clear, the sun comes out, and he thinks it was just a coincidence. But then he says, just to see, I wish it would start raining again, and it
does. So correlation indeed was causation.
Exactly. So he realizes he has the titular magic pebble. So he's heading back to his parents, and I'm sure I'm getting the details of this wrong, but I haven't read it in a while, because when I did reread it, I was like, oh my God, I'm never reading this to my dog. He comes across a lion, and as you can imagine, lions are very dangerous to donkeys. So
you don't often see them in the same place.
You don't, and there's a, you see, yeah, yeah, let's not get graphic, but yes, you don't. On those rare occasions you do. It doesn't end well for the donkey. So he panics. And he could have said, I wish I were home. I wish I were back with my parents. And instead, he says, I wish I were a rock.
What?
So he turns into a rock. The magic pebble falls onto the ground next to him. And the lion is completely confused. In fact, one of my favorite illustrations is the lion coming over to sniff the rock, just looking absolutely mystified and baffled. So when the picnic's over, Mr. and Mrs. Donkey, I can't remember what their last names were, can't find Sylvester anywhere. And they come near the rock and they're calling his name, and he can't respond.
But he can hear whatsoever.
Because he can hear. He's sentient. But he can't respond. They think it's just this rock, and they go home, and he's missing. And fall follows summer, and then it's winter, and he gets snowed on, and then it's spring again, and he's just kind of sleeping more and more and sadder and kind of hopeless. And his parents, as you can imagine, are devastated because they think he got eaten by a lion or something. So I think the father suggests the spring's coming again and it's getting nice out. He suggests that they maybe go for a picnic and, you know, just to reminisce about Sylvester. And they end up having their picnic on the rock that is Sylvester. So they cover him with a blanket and they put all the food on him. And the mother notices the red pebble and she says, Sylvester would have loved this. This would have been perfect for his collection. And she puts it on top of the rock that is Sylvester. And Sylvester is like, again, he's like in this sort of deep slumber state. And he knows it's his parents and he's like slowly waking up. And then he realizes what's happened. And he says, I wish I were myself again. And he becomes Sylvester the donkey and the picnic goes flying everywhere. And there's this wonderful reunion and they all live happily ever after. So
I don't see that as a sad story at all. It has a happy ending. What's the sad part?
Yeah. Well, okay. The idea of being so terrified that you, the thing you wish for essentially ends your life. You know, you become a being with no autonomy, with no hope. And it is just like by the slightest chance that you get made whole again. I don't know. I found the middle of that book is
Let
very
Let me ask
dark.
You this question, though. I mean, because I have a question. I mean, obviously, you know, it's that fight, flight, or freeze, and he decides to freeze. But all that time when the pebble was next to him, why couldn't he have just said, I wish I were myself again?
Because you have to be touching the pebble.
Oh, I see.
I suppose you could say it would have been worse if he had that option and didn't use it, but he didn't have the option. He needed the pebble to be touching
him.
I see. So, I thought it was going to end worse,
Mary. I thought you were going to say they have this picnic and that's it. And it's kind of like the Giving Tree where he just sacrifices himself for the greater good.
I hate that
book. Me too.
That is probably the worst, most vile children's book
ever. I used to love it until someone gave me a feminist reading of it, and then I've never liked it ever since.
Yeah, it's grotesque.
I don't mean gave me. I mean, you know, sort of awoke. Yeah. I was awoken. Awaken? I'm woke.
Oh, you got woke?
I got woke about Shel Silverstein. I mean, where does the sidewalk end, Mary? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. I mean, I guess the fact that I loved that book so much is more troubling than what the book was.
What do you think it was that, and what age were you, did you love that book, that same era? Like, or?
Yeah, 4 or 5.
What
probably.
Do you think you loved about it? And what do you remember loving about it? Were the images, or that he got to be himself again, or which part? Or did you like when he was a rock and got away from his parents?
I don't think like is the wrong word. I think it was relating to. It's really funny you should say fight, flight, or freeze, because we were talking about that the other day. And somebody mentioned the fight flight response. And I said, well, I think one of our bigger problems right now is that so many people choose freeze.
You said that on Tuesday on Nerds?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I didn't even need to be there. I was obviously there in so many respects.
Yeah. And, you know, we're living with so much paralysis. And
that's true.
I think it was just being able to have a character that experience. I had a terrible asthma as a child, it was very debilitating. And I think it was having a character that had experienced the same
thing.
Being
frozen in that way.
You know, and then gets rescued by love, essentially.
What does a lion represent in your life?
I never thought of it that way. What does a lion represent in my life? That's personal.
As a child. Okay, never mind. I mean, I thought we were going there, but I guess not.
Yeah, we are going. I'm. Let's see. The people who are willing to take advantage of those weaker and more vulnerable, I suppose. So I'm just riffing.
Well, I'm just thinking about the story differently now, because, I mean, here's the deal. Like, it was kind of good, I think, to be a rock so as not to be a tasty morsel for the lion, right? I mean, so the freeze mechanism worked, but at some point, it's hard to come out of that paralysis and know when safety is there, right?
Well, that is indeed the problem with defense mechanisms. They serve a purpose until they don't. And then they become reasons to go to therapy.
As if one needs a reason. I mean, I think I probably do need a reason. So, okay. So we, I've gotten you now to the age of five, Mary, and you're reading. should we just skip ahead to like yesterday and then like fill in the middle? Like, what are you reading now? Are you still reading Sylvester and the Magic Pebble, or what is replaced? Is there a, is it an adult book that's replaced that book as a sort of touchstone for you?
You know, I have books that I reread, and but not to be completely honest with you, sometimes I don't know why. Maybe just because they're enjoyable and it's entertaining or whatever, or I the characters resonate with me. And some books I reread aren't even necessarily, you know, great literature. But you know, I do have my favorites, my three favorite books probably, and I know it's hard to do this, but are Clarissa by Samuel Richardson, a 17th century epistolary novel, Sound and the Fury by your favorite, William Faulkner. That's sarcasm. She hates William Faulkner.
I don't hate him.
Beloved by Toni Morrison. Wuthering Heights used to be one of them, but that's because I sort of steeped in Victorian literature for a very long time. So
the Clarissa thing, is that, I'm trying to remember, when you got a master's from Columbia, was it Samuel Richardson or was it Faulkner that you wrote about, or both?
Neither. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on Clarissa. And it, if I remember correctly, it's about feminine space and the encroachment upon feminine space.
Oh, wait, your undergraduate thesis. Okay.
Yeah. And
wait, don't jump ahead yet. I want to hear about that, about Clarissa and encroachment on feminine space. What is that? I read his other book, Pamela, but I didn't read Clarissa. So what is Clarissa about?
Yeah, Pamela's sort of melodrama. I mean, I guess you could say that Clarissa is too, but it's much in its way. It's so much more brilliantly drawn. It's also like 2,000. It's huge. It's absolutely enormous book, which is one of the reasons why not that many people read it. It's quite a time commitment. And, you know, sort of as with The Sound and the Fury, I think both of those books resonate with me because they're about family in a very specific way. And I mean, basically, Clarissa is the youngest child. She's the second daughter. The oldest son is a bit of an asshole. And Clarissa is universally loved. She's beautiful, you know, both person and parts, and, you know, all sorts of talent and generous and whatever. And her grandfather favored her so much that he left his fortune to her. And as you can imagine, that left, this is the 17th century. This was not done. And it made her an independent woman, but just to, so as not to ruffle any feathers, she put it in her, the fortune in her father's care. But still, the resentments existed. These are phenomenally wealthy people.
And just so I remember, this is like 1748, this book was written.
I'm sorry, why am I saying 17th, 18th
century?
Yeah,
it's like 1748, and it's like, it could have been yesterday. It could have been your family yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it's, so essentially what happened, and it, again, it's all in letters, so it's, the letters between Clarissa and her best friend, Anna Howe, whom I adore, is one of my favorite characters in all of English literature.
I see. So it's an epistolary, they call it, novel. So it's, we're reading letters back and forth, and that's how we figure out that that her brothers, or whoever, brother is jealous of her. Who else is jealous of her for getting all this money?
Her sister, Bella, who is not particularly attractive. And not particularly bright.
So she really needed the money then, because she wasn't going to marry well, and she didn't even get it.
Well, no, I think the Harlow, the family's name is Harlow. They're so wealthy that they easily could have, you know, fixed her up with a huge dowry.
Okay, but everyone, and, somehow the grandfather loves Clarissa, gives her the money. She lets her father manage it for her, but everyone's still pissed off at her. Okay.
Right. And they have great ambitions for the son, James Jr., who's, again, just an awful, like, He's like the Stephen Miller of the Harlow family.
Like a snake?
Just arrogant, full of himself, and just grotesque and vile. And they want to make sure that James has so much wealth that he gets a peerage, you know, that he gets becomes landed gentry or whatever.
Oh, I see. And so this must take place in England, not America.
Oh,
no,
yeah, sorry.
I'm just sorry.
Yeah, I only studied... I mean, obviously, I've read a lot of American literature, but formally, I studied British literature.
Sorry to cut you off, but so we've got Clarissa, we've got the older brother James, then we have Clarissa, then there's Bella, and they're trying to make sure that mm-hmm. James is rich enough to get a peerage.
Right, and they have two uncles who are also phenomenally wealthy, unmarried, childless. So... the problem starts when a guy named Robert Lovelace.
What a good name.
Pays a visit. He's Clarissa is known far and wide as being this beautiful, accomplished, wonderful person. And he goes to pay a visit with the hopes of starting up as a suitor, right? But Clarissa's not there. There was a miscommunication, and he ends up in the same room with Bella and the rest of the family. Clarissa's not there. Bella thinks that he's kind of making advances to mm-hmm. her. And then turns out that's not at all the case. And then when he kind of tricks Bella into rejecting him, you know, that's when he sets his sights on Clarissa. Mm-hmm. So Bella is also feeling very jealous about this. James and Lovelace hate each other from college. They went to university together. And James is absolutely opposed to any of this. He's in Scotland when he hears what's going on. He comes back home and essentially provokes Lovelace into a sword fight. And Lovelace wounds James. So, you know, the whole family now hates Robert Lovelace. Clarissa still carries a flame for him, however. And
because
then,
he stabbed her brother or some other reason?
Yeah, because he said, although it was absolutely in self-defense. Uh-huh. But, you know, there's sort of no going back from that, I suppose. And again, Bella's not on Clarissa's side because she's mm-hmm. jealous. And then this man, like one of the great villains ever written about, Roger Soames, whom Clarissa and her best friend Anna Howe refer to as the odious Soames, comes into the picture. He's older. He's squat. he has the audacity to step on Clarissa's hoop. And he's awful. The only thing going for him is he has money, in which Clarissa has no interest mm-hmm. whatsoever. However, he has two massive plots of land. And I know this sort of sounds like a Monty Python sketch out of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But he's got two massive plots of land adjoining the Harlow estate, which would make them so much more. And he's willing to give it all to them because, you know, who's going to marry this guy? He's just so awful. So they essentially imprison Clarissa.
Wait, what? Where? Yeah,
they were in her room. I mean, it's probably a very nice room, and she has a separate writing closet. But she is, the only reason she is allowed to leave the house is to feed her chickens, which
is
Joyce
that
Vance
wait
would.
To feed her chickens. Does Joyce know about this book?
Yes. I gave it to her. I'm pretty sure. It's very daunting.
Okay. I have actually seen it, Mary, huge. And it's like the size of a telephone book. I mean, it's big.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, Wait. So is that how she gets the letters out to her friends, by going to the chickens, or who's delivering the letters?
Yeah, eventually her means of communication get completely cut down. She's not allowed to write anybody. Lovelace has also been corresponding with her. So she has her maid, who is a very, very loyal ally, deposit letters near where the chickens are and pick letters up there and
wait. They imprison her, but where is the odious Soames? I mean, are they imprisoning her till she gives into marriage? Is that the idea?
Yes, and they're basically their plan. I mean, this takes about 350 pages to get to.
But, spoiler alert. Fine. Go ahead and keep telling me because I'm probably not going to get to it.
Spoiler alert for all of the people who are going to read the book, is after months of like psychological manipulation and coercive control, and just making her world smaller and smaller and smaller. The plan they come up with is to knock her out, basically, and have a vicar who is they've bribed, I'm assuming, marry her to Soames while she's unconscious.
What? Wait, what? That's insane. Are you serious?
Yep. And they would have gone away with it.
If it weren't for these
insane
meddling
or not,
kids,
it was the mid 18th century. And she's completely, whether or not that would have happened, she believes it would have, and they give her.
So
every
how does she know that's what they're
would.
Plotting?
I don't
this is like Martha Mitchell territory here. They were going to knock her out. Okay, so she tells her friend, or she tells Lovelace, they're gonna drug me and make me marry this guy. It's what she thinks.
And Lovelace knows this as well, so he begs her to run away with him.
Does she love him, though?
You know, it's one of those things, I think if left to her devices, she probably would have figured him out. But by hating him so much and restricting her circle so drastically.
Well, he represents freedom. That's it.
He represents freedom. He also clearly... in her view. She it's a sort of methinks thou dost protest too much. She's always defending herself against Anna Howe's accusations that she's in love with him. And she says, no, I'm not. But also you have to remember, first of all, Lovelace is a handsome, accomplished guy, but he has a pretty bad reputation.
For stabbing her brother,
with women,
for example.
Well, no, but like he's temperate, but he's probably, he's slept around a lot. Likely he doesn't treat his family mm-hmm. particularly well. So there are lots of strikes
Does
against
he
him,
have
but
debts
they kind of,
too?
No, he did, but he's free and clear. His family, of course, is also extraordinarily
wealthy.
So
fast forward to what happens. I'm getting anxious not knowing.
Well, he basically tricks her into running away with him. And then she's on mm-hmm. the run. And the rest of the book is...
Wait, how do you get... If your money is all on your land, and it's not like you can have, like, credit cards or, like, loose diamonds. I mean, how do you run away without wealth as someone like her?
Well, she was totally dependent on him.
Ooh.
Let's put it this way.
So she gave up all of her wealth
very long
to be with this guy.
She gave up everything. And I think she still hoped, like she wasn't running away to marry him. She was just running away so she didn't have to marry Soames in the hopes that with distance and maybe finding more allies, she could convince her family that, you know, she loves them and just does. She can't marry. She said this all along. I won't marry this guy if you don't want me to. Just don't make me marry.
So structurally, how does this work? This part of the story, are these when she's run off with him, is she now sending letters to her friend at that point? Okay.
Yes. She's still communicating with Anna, and it takes Anna a while to realize how serious this is, which is kind of interesting. Because again, it seems it's surreal.
So does she turn herself into a rock, or what's the ending of this one?
You really want to know what happens?
I see no reason not to know, Mary. Otherwise, I'm going to Google it when we finish talking.
He brings Clarissa to his aunt's house, and his aunts are known to be these very upright people, but it turns out that they're really prostitutes.
Wait, what?
He tricks
Excuse
her.
Me.
He tricks her.
Wait, I was not expecting this twist at all. His upright aunts turn out to be prostitutes? How does she?
No. They weren't really his aunts.
Oh, I see.
If he had taken her to his aunts,
my God.
They would have protected her.
Wait, is this a human trafficking?
Essentially a brothel.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, in the meantime, he's communicating with his best friend, Belford. and who, by the way, ends up being Clarissa's ally, and makes it very clear that the whole goal was to humiliate the Harlow family and just,
turn her into a prostitute herself. Not turn her into a prostitute, but
kind of conquer
or
her.
Or what do we say today?
Like,
sex worker.
Marry her.
Okay. No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't about that at all. He basically wanted control over her. And the last thing that happens is, not the last thing that happens, but one of the last things that happens is the book. After all of this time, after all of this tension spilled up, he rapes her.
Oh my God, Mary. That's terrible. Yes. And that's the end of the whole book?
Yes. No, the end
does
of the book.
Does she get pregnant?
No, she does.
Oh, for...
it's really
I'm
uplifting.
Only laughing.
And then I'm only laughing
because I'm almost fucking crying that this is one of your favorite books and it's so devastating. And I'm just sitting here crushed right now and I don't even know what to say. And so the terrible lesson of this book is, woman, don't have agency. Do what your parents tell you to do. Marry whoever they say to maintain their estate. Don't go off on your own, because if you do, you'll get raped and you deserve it. And I can't believe that you like this book and have reread it.
It is brilliantly written. I mean, what, you think Sound of Fury is uplifting?
Did I say that I like that book?
Come on. Oh, no, I didn't say you liked it. I said I like it, though. So you shouldn't be surprised that I sort of tend toward...
I understand twisted family stories. Like, I like Eugene O'Neill plays. So basically, I just need a moment to collect my heart, which has just shattered into dust. Okay. Great book, Mary.
Well, what's good about the it kind of, you learn what happens to all of the other characters, and they all kind of do get their just desserts.
Really? Tell me how the parents get their just desserts, or how what happens to this awful Loveless guy? Does he die?
He dies in a duel.
Who kills him? The brother?
I don't know. Okay. No. The brother basically just gets into a miserable marriage and just has a miserable life and recognize. The good thing about it is they all recognize their guilt. It's too late, but like they all basically punish themselves until they die.
Oh my
and
God.
Except Anna Howe actually does end up having a wonderful life, and she names her daughter Clarissa and marries the person that Clarissa thought she should marry and what have you. But it's a very dark, dark book, but it is so brilliantly written, and it so reminded me of certain things about my own life, much like Sound of the Fury.
Wait, so I want to go back. Now that I know what the book is all about, tell me your thesis as an undergrad was about what?
It was about feminine space and how it gets encroached upon as a means to control. And I don't remember.
Yeah, but that's now I understand. I can understand what you.
What I can say is it wasn't very good, because as I learned in grad school, especially at the time of deconstruction and Jacques Derrida, literary
Jacques
theory
Lacan
is not my
too,
thing.
Right? We call them Jacques Lacan because why not?
Yes, because why
not? Go ahead.
It wasn't really my thing.
What literary theory wasn't your thing, or was?
That's certainly not deconstruction, but there was practically no escaping it. Psychoanalytic theory definitely made more sense to me. And that was sort of on the rise at the time. So I kind of stuck with that. But, you know, I'm a reader. I'm not my master thesis was on Wordsworth's The Prelude. Which is a poem I absolutely adore.
Really?
But even though Robert Browning is by far my favorite poet, but...
That seems wrong. I think T.S. Eliot should be your favorite poet.
Well,
We'll have to enlist Mehdi Hasan, because he wrote a book called Win Every Argument, and so I'm going to see if I can win the argument.
Yes, I read it a couple
you did?
Weeks ago.
Was it good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll read it.
You can't win an argument, because again, it's sort of like saying, "How could you not like vanilla?" I mean, I don't know. I mean, actually, I do like vanilla. I appreciate T.S. Eliot. I'm sort of hampered by his hideous misogyny.
Yeah, and his anti-Semitism, but his poetry.
Yeah, and all of it. But I understand.
I'm going to stick with Clarissa for a moment. So when you're an undergraduate, I want to say that you were at Tufts. Is that right? And at times, maybe you went home, and I'm just curious if any of your family members noticed that you were reading books, or were you like Matilda, where they were all like, I'm just trying to imagine whether any of your, like, your grandfather, your grandmother, your uncle, your cousins, your mom, did they go, what is that book about, Mary? I mean, did you ever talk about literature with any of those other Trumps? Why are you laughing?
Because the idea is so fucking absurd.
Well, did they read those other Trumps?
No. My mother read, I know my grandmother read romance novels that she got from the library, like, you know, what's her name? The really, really popular one back when
like
we
Joan
were
Collins
kids.
Or something? Or
not quite, but that in that mm-hmm. vein of, I'm sure she read Joan Collins too, but my mother probably read similar kinds of books from the library. But no, nobody in my family fucking read.
But when you said you were going to get a master's degree in literature, did anyone say
why?
What
do you want to do that for? That's stupid. What do you want to do that for? That's stupid.
And what did you say in response?
What do you say in response? It's what I want to do. I don't know. So no, there was... To the extent they even remembered I existed, no, there were no conversations about, in fact, once we were at, I think it was Father's Day or something, and my brother, or it was before Father's Day, my brother had mentioned that he had read John Krakauer's...
Into Thin
not
Air?
Not Into Thin Air.
No.
No, the other one.
The one, Into the Wild?
Into the Wild. And sorry, not John Krakauer. The Perfect Storm.
Oh, Sebastian,
younger or something. I don't know. Anyway, so I'm like, oh, okay, Father's Day is coming up. We're gonna be seeing each other. So let me read the book, so we have something to talk about. And we find ourselves next to each other. I'm like, oh, by the way, I read Perfect Storm, and it's like, oh yeah, and he walked away. So there was no conversing
about books,
about the literary, about anything, really. I mean, that's why books are so important to me, because, you know, I needed to have that kind of expanded fantasy life in my head. Like that was where I went. That's why I think when I was a kid, when I was a little bit older, science fiction was so vital to my intellectual
Which
growth.
Which science fiction? Like Ray Bradbury or Ursula Le Guin?
Asimov. Uh-huh. Isaac Asimov was my absolute favorite.
Huh.
Although The Martian Chronicles is my favorite science fiction book of all time by Ray Bradbury. I read everything Ray Bradbury wrote, but he crossed the line into fantasy a lot, which I didn't really appreciate when I was a kid. But, you know, Heinlein and Herbert and Jose... Farmer. I mean, I read everything.
So you like to basically occupy these other possible worlds because yours felt small, or what was, because I think science fiction is a lot different from, you know, the novels you're describing. You know, Faulkner isn't at all. I mean, he seems very anchored in, you know, blood and sweat and family and history and land. And so what is it about science fiction mm-hmm. that was intriguing to you?
I think it just gave me permission to be untethered from reality in a way that I couldn't often be.
Were you one of these people who, if your parents took you to a family event or if you were on the bus somewhere, you always had a book with you?
Yeah. But I was also very sociable, unlike now. Like I'm a very shy, introverted person now. And I was an introvert when I was a kid, but I was also very outgoing in a way I'm not anymore. So it was this really weird balance that I struck between being this athletic, outgoing person and this very interior kind of hyper intellectual person who read a lot and eventually started writing a lot.
When did you start writing? Yeah. You notice I'm skipping over the sports because I don't even know how to go there.
It's not what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it's also because Waj and I are really into football and you're not. And I guess your sport is like, your sports are tennis and sailing and archery. Is that what you do?
Well, when I was a kid, my best sports were sailing, archery, and soccer, probably. But I didn't, tennis was like my seventh sport. But we watched it. We watched all the Grand Slams, and I didn't start playing tennis until I was like 40.
Who's we? You said we watch.
Oh, my family.
When you say my family, do you mean your mom or your dad?
My mother.
So you would sit with your mom and watch tennis?
The Grand Slams, right, were the only things televised, as far as I know. And I went to school in Forest Hills, which, when I was a kid, is where the U.S. Open was held. So. That was kind of a big deal too.
Right. Did you go there a lot each fall?
Not all the time. We went on occasion, but anyway, it has nothing to do with reading.
But when did you start writing though?
I don't remember a time that I didn't, quite honestly.
Did you keep journals?
No, I wrote bad poetry and science fiction short stories.
Do you have any?
Which were also bad, probably. No, I don't have any. I actually, because I read a lot of science fiction journals, you know, those little books, those little booklets that were like the same size as the Reader's Digest. It came out every month.
I think my father had a subscription to those, and I forgot what it was called, Analog, or it was some...
Yeah, Science Fiction Analog. There were a bunch of them. There were a bunch of them. And I actually sent in this very terrible short story I wrote when I was 12. And the editor actually wrote back to me.
Yeah, that's sweet.
That's not nice. I mean, it was rejected, of course, but just the fact that he took that. And it was a nice letter.
Like,
it was very
Was it like keep writing or something like that? Or
yeah, like he pointed out the problems with the story. Like it was terrible. No, he was very kind about it. And the criticisms were constructive. So.
And you have written, as we know, two books. Too Much and Never Enough and The Reckoning, both of which I have read and loved. And are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I actually am working on my next book.
Do you want to talk about it or are you keeping it top secret?
I'm keeping it a little, I'm keeping it close to the vest. But it is like neither of the other books I've written. It's still nonfiction, though. I spent most of my life through grad school writing fiction, and I had every intention of becoming a novelist. You know, things happen. So the fact that I've written two books of nonfiction is something I never, ever would have anticipated, and that I'm working on my third. But I this is one I just feel like I need to get it out of my system, and then, you know, hopefully I'll have the luxury of writing some nonfiction down the road. I'm sorry, fiction.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, it's funny, because I know you, there are things I would ask someone else, but maybe I don't ask you, but I'll pretend I don't know you. And I'll say, you know, a little bit ago, you said you used to be very social, but you're not anymore. Why? I mean, I think I know, but I'm curious what you'll say.
I'm not.
But when did that change? Think, you said as a kid, you'd have your book, but you know.
Yeah. It changed after my dad died. He died when I was 16, and it, not that there's a good time for this to happen, but it happened at a particularly bad time. I had just started. He died two weeks after I started at a new boarding school. So I didn't know anybody. It was a tough transition to begin with. I mean, I was handling it okay, but you know, I had never been new before. I started going to camp when I was six, the summer before first grade. And I'd been in the same school since first grade. So I'd had the same group of friends forever. So not being new when
that's already traumatic because
really,
you don't have yourself mirrored back. Yeah. You don't know who you are around people. Right.
And it was junior year and very few people start. So there weren't a lot of new people coming into my grade. So, yeah, so it was tricky. And then my dad died, and that kind of changed the course of events, really. So I think just from then I was sort of working from a deficit for a really long time. College, first time I went to grad school. And, you know, those things kind of take their toll. And then I became just a more shy, more interested. I mean, I got to the point where, you know, I was perfectly capable of, you know, being among people, but it wasn't my default, mm-hmm. you know. So that all got exacerbated exacerbated since November 2016. I can explain why. You probably don't know why that date has any significance, but
I mean it seems important in world events, but you personally, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, who knows
what you're talking about?
Yeah. So who knows? You know, just sort of another instance in which the trauma happened, but under like less than ideal circumstances, because as in boarding school, I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. I was living in a town that was not the easiest place for me to live under the best of circumstances. And after the election, like that became much more salient because, you know, it's a pretty Republican town. And which hadn't mattered before.
I mean, what was that like that people in your town or people in your close circle of friends had voted for your uncle? I mean, I can't imagine.
Yeah, it was pretty hurtful. And again, I mean, it's not like I'm not going to tell people how to vote, and I'm not going to punish them for voting a particular way, but it did hurt mm-hmm. me. You know, I did kind of take it personally. And I just became very, very withdrawn after that.
I mean, your story is the same, obviously, amplified. I mean, so many of us were so distressed that our family members, I mean, you know, a lot of people like me who are progressives, you hear politicians say this, that they had family members, whether it was Elizabeth Warren or I think even Eric Swalwell, you hear them saying, yeah. You know, everyone had some family member maybe out there or a friend, someone who voted for him. But to have it be him, be your own family, and then these friends, and you know, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry for you. And the fact that I was trying to avoid discussing him, but he's probably be running. I mean, he's running and he's probably going to be the nominee. How are you preparing yourself mm-hmm. other than trying to, you know, find a magic pebble and turn into a rock again? What are you?
Well, that's what I tried.
You
at
tried
first.
That.
Yeah, I did.
What
try
can
that.
You do now to brace yourself for this, not all over again, but maybe worse this time around? I mean, I don't know how he could possibly win, but he could.
Well, I said that back in 2016 before the election. It's like just the fact that he had a 0.0001% chance of winning was just horrifying, you know, that America was willing to take
that. Well,
it's
always going to be close to 50-50 given how the populace and how the electoral college is, whoever gets the nomination. So it's too close for comfort, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he what quote unquote won, and I continue to believe that the election in 2016 was totally illegitimate.
37,000 votes in three states, and we can see what they're trying to do. Even about 2020,
37,000 votes in three states, right?
Popular vote. So, he's never
because
won.
Of the evil, racist electoral college. But anyway, and you know, that's all they're working on right now is rigging it. But listen, it won't be a surprise. I think I could say that, I dearly hoped that after 2020, the Republican Party would reject him, not because they were going to do the right thing, but because they recognized that was just the wrong road to keep going down. And they did it. And I think that was the last time I had hope about that situation. So now I just think that he's inevitable. And, you know, because who knows? I mean, how different my life would have been if he had just gone away. I don't know.
You know, but, the only thing I'll say is I might not have met you because all the things that conspired for us to be in the same knitting group on Zoom, I'm not sure I would have met those other people who put us together, right?
Didn't we? No, because this was 2020 already. I'm not talking about 2016.
Oh,
I'm talking
never
about
mind.
2020.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So, if you'd gone away. I think you meant and not run. I see. Gone away in 2020. I get you. Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, nothing could be as bad as 2016. Right. I mean, that was a massive trauma, partially because it was unthinkable to me.
Yes.
And now,
but 2020 is pretty damn awful because it's still ongoing, and he and his followers and a huge majority of the Republican Party, and, you know, I don't know, at least a third of the country are believing the big lie. And it just, I don't know how we have a democracy right now, if you can call it that.
Yeah, well, we don't. But I think the worst part of 2020, besides the fact that he just didn't go away, was that the Republican Party became wholesale a fascist part, anti-democratic party. But that's good information to have, right? We know what we're up against. And I know he's going to be the nominee, and I'm prepared for that. So, you know, again, nothing could be as bad as 2016 was. And I have a much, much better support system now than I did in 2016, certainly. But again, the problem is that even though some things are better, it all takes a toll. And, it's sort of how one is positioned to, because, sometimes I've written about this a lot. I've talked about this a lot. You can't recover from trauma to the extent that one can recover from trauma if you're in the midst of being traumatized.
I keep forgetting that. You're right.
Yeah.
Good point.
And that makes it very difficult to lean on people. It makes it difficult to make use of your support system and your safety net. And, I have a tendency to isolate, and that becomes much more damaging than anything Donald's doing, Like, I try really not to pay attention. I don't ignore him because I can't. None of us can. But I don't seek out anything he's doing or writing.
Well, how can you miss it? I mean, he's everywhere. Not as much, though.
Yeah, but I don't listen to his stupid, I let other people tell me what's going on with him. And, I know he's a threat. Yeah. So there you go. We'll deal with it when we have to deal with it.
Are there any family members that you have that you stay in contact with who are, I wonder about, well, I guess maybe not because of the lawsuit. Never mind. I was going to ask about your aunt who you might have been close with once. So I guess not.
I have a very small family, but my daughter is like one of the best people I've ever known. So that makes up for a lot.
She's graduating from college soon. Congratulations.
Yeah, she is indeed. Thank you.
I can't believe we are almost done. And I want to see, is there something I didn't ask you or you wanted to tell me that we didn't cover?
Yeah, I think we started to talk about this at the beginning and then we got sidetracked in a really lovely way. So I'm quite happy that we went where we went, but I do think it is important to remind people that, reading is so important. Like I stopped reading for a while, which basically meant that I was disconnected from an essential part of myself. And I think you were visiting, when I decided to kind of teach myself how to read again. And I chose some really short, not particularly challenging books to start with, like books that maybe I wouldn't typically have read. But, a couple of months ago, decided that I wanted to reread Henry James's oeuvre.
Oh, I love him.
And it is basically, I think it's helping my brain rewire itself. I haven't gotten that far because as you do probably, I have to read a lot of nonfiction, which I never used to do. I just read Mehdi's book and I've had to read a bunch of others and that's fine. And that's good because I learn a lot, but fiction is the thing that kind of heals
me.
And it just makes me a better thinker. And certainly it makes me a better writer.
I agree. No, I'm glad you said that. And I'm hoping that I begin to read fiction again. I do it almost like having dessert too sparingly, but it is very delicious. But I'm trying to be nutritious, I guess, with my reading. Well, it's been so good talking with you, Mary. And I hope we can do this again. If you'll forgive me, because I know you and Waj are giving me so much trouble about getting booked on the show.
Oh, it was done with love.
I mean, you know.
But yeah, I hope you'll have me on when I finish my next. Actually, I'm working on a couple of book projects, so maybe you'll have me on when I finish one.
So where did Mary, you know, for people who don't know how to find you, where can they find you, find your writing and find you?
I have a Substack newsletter called The Good in Us. I should probably know that address, but I don't. Just, you know, if you want to Google Mary Trump Substack or The Good in Us, you'll get there. I also have a show that you are a regular on, The Mary Trump Show. We've got three episodes a week, and Jen and Waj Ali and a few other people are on every Tuesday with me. We call ourselves
so
the
Nerd Avengers.
So that's
Tuesday at noon?
Because we are. That's Tuesday at noon. I have an interview show Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, and a third episode called The House of Horrors on Fridays at noon, in which we talk about whatever awful things have been going on in Kevin McCarthy's House of Representatives. And I'm on Twitter still at Mary L. Trump. I have not had the... I think I just don't want to face up to the reality of how broken Twitter is. So I have not made the jump to any of the alternatives yet. I'm really resisting it. But Elon Musk has destroyed what had been this extraordinary community, this extraordinary aggregator of information. And yeah, I'm just, I haven't grappled.
I have
with
one
yet.
More thing.
So I'm still
Shoot, I
there.
Forgot to ask you.
Yeah.
When and if your uncle is indicted, I know at one time, didn't you say something like America was going to run out of beer? But will you have an emergency Nerd Avengers immediately?
Oh my God, of course. But for those people who do celebrate with alcohol, it will be compulsory.
And for those who don't,
you have to
there's going to be plenty of non-alcoholic Diet Coke.
Non-alcoholic beer, a Diet Coke, a Snapple.
But please drink
whatever
you drink responsibly and don't operate motor vehicles or machinery.
Well, nope. I typically discourage people on my show from joining while driving. This doesn't make any sense at all. So, we will all be safely at home. And, unless you don't drink, which I'm all for, by the way, it's hard to imagine.
Okay, let's do this.
That.
Let's place a friendly wager, Mary. Let's just close out the show today by placing a friendly wager on when we think the first indictment's going to come down. I was wrong. I thought it was going to be in February. You won't do it? Just a wager?
No,
you're no fun.
No, I've been kicked in the teeth so many times. I'm literally at this point where just tell me when it happens. I can't keep anticipating. I've had so many reversals. We've had so many false alarms and it's really debilitating. So I'm sorry not to be fun, but I don't think it's good for me to engage in these.
Okay, well, just please text me. I might be teaching class or doing something else. I don't want to miss it.
Oh, I'll be, I'll send an owl.
An owl?
So you good.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm making a note. The owl.
That's more effective than a
text. So just an owl. Like that's what I'm going to, okay, that's what I'm going to do. Okay, whenever, if, when the indictment comes down, I'm just, it's going to be all owls all the time. Thanks, Mary. That was great speaking with Mary, and I really do look forward to her next book and all the ones after that, especially when she delves into the world of fiction writing. I also am stunned that I fell into the trap of finding or getting that spoiler about Clarissa. But I guess that, you know, I did walk her along that path. What I think I want to do next to get to know my friend a bit better is go to my local public library and find a copy of Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. Or actually, maybe I'm going to actually buy a copy and annotate it for her to say who the lion is and who the pebble is and then send it to her. But I guess I can't do that as a surprise because she's probably going to listen to the show. Oh, well. Well, let's hope that sometime soon I find an owl at my doorstep and I know that the reckoning for her odious uncle has arrived. Thanks, everyone. I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com or write to me the old-fashioned way at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.